So let's get started. I will return the exams next week. I was hoping to get them done this week, but it's like an abbreviated week with the holiday tomorrow, so grading is not yet complete. But Tuesday I'm hoping to get it all back to you.
But you could grade all day tomorrow since there's no classes.
Yeah, all night as well. I'm getting a little bit of help from the TAs, but we will get it done one way or another. So, reminder that there is a lab out. I'm going to discuss that now. I ran out of time last time. But just a quick recap before I switch to the lab. We were talking about file systems last time. Okay, so what we have done is essentially looked at the interface, the file system exports to the user. We looked at the system called interface, and we looked at how many of these operations are implemented inside the OS kernel. So what we are going to do today is look at how the file system organizes the files on disks, how it creates files, how it deletes files, what data structures are maintained. So all of that is the basis for today's discussion. Okay, but before we go there, let's talk a little bit about... Okay, that's not good. Okay. The machine is old and tired. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the next lab, which has been up since late last week. Okay, so this lab is going to be on memory management. Essentially, we will have you implement two of the memory management techniques we discussed in class, okay, namely paging and segmentation. Okay, so since the assignment is going to be done in Java, you are not really going to implement paging or segmentation. You will instead implement a simulator for paging or and segmentation. If this was a C class in C or C++, we could have been a bit more ambitious, but with Java you can only go so far. Okay, so the goal is to write a simulator that will essentially simulate how segmentation and paging works. What the input to your simulator will essentially be a trace file which shows, which lists arrivals and departures of processes. Okay, so you will basically get a request saying new process has arrived, it needs so much memory. Okay, and then as a real kernel would do, your simulator has to actually go and say, if I were to do pure segmentation, this is where I would put this process in RAM. Okay, so essentially you have to keep track of all of the data structures that the kernel keeps track of. What are the processes that are currently in the system? What memory have you allocated to them? What parts of memory are free? So all of that your simulator needs to track. Okay, and hence whenever a new process arrives, you allocate more memory. When a process departs, you basically deallocate memory. For simplicity here, we are going to assume processes don't grow or shrink. Okay, in reality, OS kernel has to deal with process growth or reduction in process address sizes as the process continues execution. Here we will assume that when the process comes in, whatever memory you have allocated to the process is it for the lifetime of the process. Okay, so essentially you have to emulate both of these schemes. So first is segmentation. So we will assume that each process has three segments. Okay, every process comes in, it has only three segments: a code segment, a heap segment, and a data segment. And the sizes, the total size of the process and the total size of each segment is given to you at process arrival time. Essentially, you have to find holes in your memory. This is contiguous allocation. Segmentation is going to be contiguous allocation. So you have to track all the holes in RAM, and you have to basically fit these three segments in memory wherever you find the holes to do so. Okay. Each segment itself is contiguous, but the three segments don't have to be contiguous. You can put the text segment somewhere, the code in the heap segment and the stack segment somewhere else. Okay, so you don't need to have a contiguously laid out process, but each segment itself is contiguous. Okay, so let's assume that's RAM. Okay, anything that is shaded is something that's already allocated. So right now you have the shaded region is allocated, the not shaded ones are holes that are free. Okay, that's free wrap. So when a new process comes in, might say code segment is X kilobytes, heap segment is Y, and stack is Z. So you have to find regions that are big enough for each of these. Okay, so you might put the code segment there and create a hole. Choose to put the heap here and the stack somewhere else. Okay. You can use any policy you want to track down holes. You can choose best fit, first fit, or worst fit. The choice is yours. Okay. The assignment doesn't specify which policy you use to figure out how to assign holes to segments, or rather segments to holes. Okay, so you decide what policy you want and then justify in your README file why you decided to pick that policy. Maybe it was good design choice, maybe it was easy to implement, doesn't matter. Whatever made you choose that, you have to write a small justification. Okay, and then there is one additional thing here. So to prevent small holes, very tiny holes, what we have specified is if when you put a segment in a hole, the leftover hole is less than 16 bytes in size, then allocate the full hole, which means there will be some internal fragmentation. We say there is no point tracking any holes that are smaller than 16 bytes in size. Okay, so if you have to allocate a segment and the leftover hole is very small, then we don't create it. We just allocate the entire hole to the segment to begin with. Okay, so that will create internal fragmentation. Okay, so that's segmentation. Okay, so essentially you have to write a Java class that will allow you to do all of this. Okay, so there's a template class provided. The algorithms are not, okay, but the API is provided here, which says there's an allocate process, a deallocate process, and print memory stats. No, don't try to read this, it's too small. Okay, it's a class which says that's the API that is going to be used to invoke your memory manager. Okay, the inside implementation depends on whether you use segmentation or paging. Okay, so when you call allocate, you'll specify the bytes, which is the size of the process, a process ID, and the text of the size of the text, the data, and the heap segment. So all of this is specified. You will run your policy that you implemented, first fit, worst fit, and allocate those segments, okay, or lay them out in memory. Okay, when you say deallocate with the process ID, then those segments will be freed up. You have to basically add them back to the free pool list of holes. Okay. So one thing to keep in mind is what is called free block coalescing. Okay, so this basically takes two adjacent holes and joins them together to create one bigger hole. And the reason it arises is as follows. Okay, so let's suppose that's RAM. This is a segment that's currently allocated. Is a hole and a hole. Okay, so suppose the process to which this segment belongs terminates, it finishes. Okay, so essentially this will get freed up. Okay, so now what you have are three holes that are all adjacent to one another. Rather than treating them as three independent holes, you need to merge them, which is called coalescing, so that they basically become one bigger hole. Okay, otherwise you will have a lot of memory fragmentation. Okay, so this is basically a trivial way to take holes and sort of combine them to make bigger holes. Okay, whenever you have adjacent holes, make one bigger hole with them. Okay, so this you need to implement. So whenever a process departs, you need to track whether this hole can be combined with any adjacent hole that's already present in RAM and make a bigger one. So that's segmentation. Any questions there? Anything I can? There will be more discussion next time in the lab, in the discussion section. But I will assume by that time you would have actually started. Anthony is going to lead that discussion. This is just introduction to the lab. Okay. So let me finish the second part. The second part is to implement paging. Okay, so you basically have the same list of arrival processes. But now you will assume that your RAM is basically paged. Okay. No demand paging, just simple paging. So So RAM has a sequence of frames, okay, to which you can assign pages. Whenever a process comes in, you take its size, you make some pages out of it, and you assign them to free frames in memory. And you have to keep a page table which tracks where each page is located in RAM. Okay, for every process, you will need to keep track of a page table. Okay, that tells you where the process is laid out. Okay, so here you will need to keep track of free frames. Whenever a process comes in, you will have to find n frames, then is the size of the process, and just allocate pages to those frames. Okay, and then keep track of a page table that will track where the process is laid out in memory. Okay, when the process departs, you take deallocate the page table, take all the frames that are freed up and add them back to the free page list. Okay, you have to keep track of which pages are free, so they will go back to the free page list. Okay, so that's basically how paging will work. Okay, the one other thing you need to track is basically fragmentation in either of those schemes. Okay, if you have internal fragmentation, paging is going to have some internal fragmentation. You need to track how much internal fragmentation has occurred for all the processes that are currently resident. Okay, for segmentation, there may also be external fragmentation, and you are supposed to track or flag whenever external fragmentation occurs, okay, which means a process comes in, there is sufficient free RAM, but not all of it is contiguous, so you can't allocate the segments to RAM. Okay, and then you'll have to basically say there's external fragmentation and sort of indicate that. Okay, so basically the API is given, which says what are the methods that are used to invoke the memory manager. The policies, which is segmentation and paging, you have to implement. Okay, use your own classes and so on. Okay, so this is how the input to your program is going to look like. So you might have an arrival event, a departure event, and then something that says print the current state of your RAM. Okay, in an arrival event, a process arrives. Okay, you specify its size and all its segment sizes, and that's what you need to allocate. The departure event, the departure of a process occurs, and then you free up RAM. Okay, whenever you say print, you will have to print out what are the processes, where you have allocated segments, what is essentially your free memory going to look like. Okay, that's the current state of processes and RAM. That's something you need to print, okay, by tracking or walking through all of your data structures and printing it out. Okay, here is a simple input that looks, okay, your question is.
You put up like a simple output for that input. There's a little bit of output, but it's for a different input.
Okay, I can do that. Anything else you want to know? We'll provide some sample output. So it's reasonably straightforward, okay, but some work has to be done to implement segmentation, paging, tracking, fragmentation, etc. Okay? So I presume not very many of you have started. 2 weeks. If deadline is 2 weeks, so this is due a week from this Friday. Okay, so one of those 2 weeks will be almost gone. So please start.
When was this put up?
It was put up late last week.
Ah.
I said it would be out by Friday, which is what we did. So we gave 2 weeks from the time it came out. Okay, so time is running out. Okay, don't wait until the last minute to get started. Yeah, because after this, there's one more assignment which I want to hand out before the Thanksgiving break. Okay? Any questions on this before I switch back to the lecture? Okay, so go look at this. I just wanted to present it here so it appears on your radar screen. There's no discussion this week, so we essentially missed one discussion section where this could have been dealt with in more detail. Okay, but Anthony is going to do all of that next week. Right? But that's only 2 days away from the deadline, really. You should never give them the source code. What do you mean?
Oh, last time you gave the source code.
Really?
No.
Okay. Alright. Let's move back to the lecture here. Okay, so last time we were talking about referential naming, okay, or aliases, which allow you to have multiple names for the same file. So it's important for the takeaway is it's important to understand what a hard link does, what a soft link or a symbolic link does, and what a copy command is. Okay, so in this case you have two names for the exact same file. Okay, so both A and A, B are names for the same file. In this symbolic link, B is essentially a soft alias for A. Okay, essentially B is a forwarding address, is a pointer to A. Okay, it's not the name for a file. It just says if you try to open B, you'll basically get a message saying go look at A, and then you actually have to go and open A. In this case, if you open B, you are actually opening the file directly. Okay, when you do a copy, which is somebody asked what happens when you cut and paste, it's like doing a copy. Okay, so you have two files which have the exact same content, but they're completely independent files. Okay, the contents are identical, the files are different. Okay, so it's important to understand from a file system perspective what all of these things mean. Okay, the other thing to keep in mind, I did this at the very end, is in whenever you have hard links, okay, you are not allowed to have hard links on directories. You can only have multiple names for the same file, but not for the same directory. Okay, and this is the reason for this is to prevent. Okay. The reason for this is to prevent loops through the file system hierarchy. Okay, basically loops are bad. So if you have a link that goes back to a parent directory, then you are going to have a loop. Okay, as is shown here, this is a subdirectory F which links back to a parent directory D. Okay, so in this case, many programs, okay, like backup programs, will basically loop forever. Okay, they will go into an infinite loop because they will not terminate. Okay, so to prevent this, you essentially prevent hard links. You can have soft links, and that's okay because these programs essentially are written to avoid soft links. Hard links you cannot distinguish. You don't actually know that a file name is a hard link. Okay, soft links you can actually check. If it's a soft link, you can ignore it. Okay, so yes.
Why is it useful to have hard links?
They are an artifact of the original file system design. They still exist. In some cases they are useful because you can actually create a directory and have a different name and it's indistinguishable. Okay, so you can have some file somewhere but then go to it in a different way. But for all practical purposes, soft link also do that, except for the problem of dangling pointers. If you delete the original, the soft link doesn't go away. Okay, so that's the only reason. But most modern ones, actually you don't actually expose hard links. Most of the time you will, when you create a shortcut in Windows, a alias in Mac OS X or something like that, that's essentially soft links, not hard links. Okay, so that is enough for most practical purposes. Okay, but hard links do exist. Okay, so couple of slides that we couldn't cover last time. So just as we looked at a variety of file system operation, there are similar system calls to manipulate directories, okay, which I will not go into at the same level of detail. So you can create a directory using the make dir command, just as you create a file using the create system call. You can delete a directory. You can list all files in a directory. Whenever you do dir in Windows or ls, okay, essentially you invoke a system call. That system call allows you to list all the file contents. Okay, so that's a directory operation. You can rename things. Okay, when you rename a file, that's a directory operation, really. Because all that you are doing is changing the entry in the directory. Okay, the file number doesn't change. All you have changed is the string or the name associated with that file. Okay, so you go and just update the directory. Nothing else changes when you rename a file. Okay, and you have recursive operations to travel a file system tree. Okay, so that is also a system call. Because all of these operations exist, we will not go into them in detail here. So just keep that in mind. Okay, the last system feature that we will look at quickly is protection and sharing. Okay, so most file systems will allow you some ability to decide which files are private, which files can be shared. The files can be shared, who do you share it with? Okay, there are various mechanisms to do that. Okay, so one is called access control lists, which is basically what is used in many file systems. Unix has a shorter version of it, which is basically access control bits. Okay, so if you take a file, In Unix, let me start with the simple one. The way you can decide whom to share it with is that all files essentially have three categories: the owner of the file, the group to which that user belongs, and everyone else, which is also referred to as world. Okay? And you can independently set read, write, and execute privileges for each of these three groups for every file. Okay, so there's a read, write, execute. So these can be independently set for each of these three. Okay? So you can control, depending on who is in a certain group, you can control what privileges they get. The, typically the owner has full privileges and they can change these bits as they wish. Okay? For the group, depending on which Unix group the owner of this file belongs to, you can allow read, write or execute privileges. If you open up the file to everyone, then everybody has access to it. So this is essentially the three categories. It's much more coarse grain way of sharing. Okay? The generalization of this is what is called access control list. Okay? This is a common security feature. They're called ACLs. Okay? Access control list. Access control list is a list that you associate with any resource. Okay? In this case, the resource happens to be a file, but this is a more general mechanism. Okay, it's a list that you associate with any resource that says who has access to that resource. Okay, in this case, the resource is a file, but you can have this resource associated with a machine, with printers. You can have ACLs for practically anything. Okay, you can put them in firewalls, security firewalls, and so on. Essentially, for every file, in this case, if you have an ACL-based file system, you will have a list. Okay, list of users or list of groups that say what permissions do these users have on these files. Okay, so you can say user 1. Okay, so you can start, owner is always part of the ACL, so you have, let's say, read, write, execute. So you can add a list of users. User 1 you can say as read, user 2 as read and write, and so on. Okay, list can be arbitrary in size. You can have 1,000 users if you want associated in an ACL belonging to a file. For every file, you can do this fine grain sharing by saying these are the n users that can have access to these files, and these are the types of accesses. Okay? So that's basically what is done in Windows NT. By default, Linux also supports ACLs now. Most modern Linux file systems, ext3 and so on, have this, and so does the Mac OS X file system. Okay, by default, let me show you a couple of things here. It's not the same terminal. So if you do ls minus l, you will actually see the access control bits associated with every file. Okay. So when you say dash, that means so first three entries are owner, the next three are for user, group, the last three for world. Okay, and you can change them as you wish. Okay, so let's create actually we do have the bar file still. Okay, so here is just to simplify. Okay, so that's the file that has only read and write permission for the owner, no access control for anyone else. Okay, you can change that. So you can use a command called change mod. Now I've just allowed read write permissions for the group to which I belong, and that group here is called staff. Okay, it's just a standard Unix group. Okay, if you want to make it accessible to everyone, you can do that too.
It should be 7.
No, I'm just trying to put 6. Okay. So now you have essentially changed it, okay, to allow read-write privileges. Okay, this is the Unix way. Okay, although now this is Mac is also a flavor of Unix, but Mac also supports ACLs. So if you actually So here is bar. So here you can see the three sets of permissions we added. This is owner, read, write, this is the group, and this is everyone else. Okay, now you can add to this whatever users you want. Okay, so that will make it an access control list. So here is a set of users. So we'll have this user, which is added to the ACL, and it shows up here, okay, as read only. Yeah, I can change that to whatever we want.
Can you display that in terminal?
There is a command, I'm not sure what it is actually. Okay, so you see that there is a plus here now. That plus says that in addition to the standard one, there's access control list associated with it. There is some flag that allows you to display that. I cannot remember what it is. Okay, but you can have this, an arbitrary list here. And for each user, each group, you can have whatever permission you want. That allows you to control what permissions or what users or groups have access to this file. Okay? And that's essentially what's called an access control list. Any questions on this? Okay. So now, go back to file system. So that concludes the discussion on the API. Okay, now we are going to peek inside the file system and see what is inside. How does the file system organize files on disk? Okay, what data structures are maintained? How can you lay out data on disks and so on? Okay, so that's basically implementation of the file system. To understand that, okay, to understand some of the design decisions, you first need to understand the nature of the device. Okay, so we will look at magnetic hard disks and see how they work. Yes, today you can actually buy machines with solid state disks. Yes, solid state disks actually behave very differently from traditional hard drives. So if you are to design a file system for a solid state disk, you would design it differently. Okay, some of these design decisions we are going to talk about today may not apply if your machine has a solid state disk. This laptop here actually has a solid state disk. It doesn't have a traditional magnetic disk. Okay, so if you are to optimize that file system for this kind of device, you may do something else. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. But for now, we will ignore SSDs or solid state disks. We'll just look at how traditional disks work, and then we'll see how to organize data on this traditional disk to improve the efficiency of the file system or get good performance. Okay. So I meant to actually bring a hard disk, but I forgot. I left it in my office, so we'll have to make do with a picture. Okay, so the picture to keep in mind when you think of a hard disk is that of a CD or a DVD. Okay, what is inside a hard disk is not very different from the way CDs or DVDs work. And I'll explain what that means. Okay, so that's a picture of what is called a platter, okay, of a hard disk. So if you can think of that as a simple DVD-ROM disk or a CD drive. Okay. So essentially, the data is recorded on a platter, okay, so a circular platter. Okay. And essentially, there are things called tracks, circular, which are concentric tracks, which is where data is recorded either on a magnetic, on your hard drive, or on a DVD. Okay, so this is the surface of the DVD where the data is. Okay, so regardless of whether it's a movie or data or whatever, this is going to be recorded in this fashion. Okay, so these circular things are called tracks or also cylinders. Okay, each track is partitioned into smaller fixed size chunks called sectors. So each sector is typically something like 512 bytes. Okay, so you can store bits or magnetically record bits on it. So that gives you about 512 bytes. Okay, if you actually run some hard disk scan and you get something called bad sector, essentially it's saying that one of these regions on your disk has gone bad. Okay, and the file system will then ignore that and not record any data on it anymore. Okay, that's essentially what it is. So each track has some number of sectors. Each sector is of fixed size, okay, 512 bytes or something along these lines. Okay, and then there are multiple tracks or cylinders. Okay. So this is basically what you have when you pop this thing into a DVD drive or a CD drive. What is there in the drive is essentially a record read-write head. Okay, read-write head basically is there some. So this thing is, when you insert it, it will start spinning. Okay, so let's say it spins this way. Okay. There's a read-write head basically that can move back and forth, and it can position itself on one of these tracks. Okay, when it's positioned on a certain track, it can read or write bits that are recorded on that track. Is that clear? Yes. Question.
So is it a spiral or is it just?
It's not a spiral. Right. They are each is a circle. It's not like it's spiraling out. Okay, so you have to actually go move the disk head. Yes, I'm not. Yes, go ahead.
So do cylinders towards the outside have more sectors?
Okay, that's a good question. I'll come. So let me answer that. But I was going to come to it. So the question is, as you can see, as you go outer, these cylinders become bigger. Right? Presumably, there is more space. The circumference of this circle is going to be bigger. So there's more space. Okay. So question is, do they have more sectors? Okay. This depends on whether this depends on the type of the disk. Okay, whether it's what's called uniform recording density or non-uniform recording density. Old disks did not have any variation. You would have the same number of sectors regardless of where you are recording. Okay, so if this track had 10 sectors, so would this track. Here just the sector would be bigger, the bits would be separated further apart. Okay, here the sector would be smaller, so the bits would be packed closer to one another. Okay. Now, clearly, this is not optimal. So, more modern disks use non-uniform recording, which means that essentially outer tracks will have more sectors than inner tracks. Okay, you will basically keep the bits spaced at the same distance from one another, which means that here, 4 bits will occupy this much space. So, there will be more bits to record because this is a bigger track. Okay, so these kinds of disks are called zoned disks. Okay, so you don't need to know that for this class, but because there's a question here. So each of these tracks will be partitioned into zones. Okay, within a zone, you'll have the same number of sectors, but as you go to outer zones, there will be more and more sectors, and there will be some number of zones on your disk. Okay, but that's not what we need to think about here. That's just an aside. So what is important to keep in mind is there is a single read-write head. This read-write head can go back and forth. It can actually move back and forth and position itself on a certain track. Okay? Once it's positioned on that track, so right now this disk read-write head is here, it's positioned on this track, it can read the bits. Okay, as the bits spin by, okay, it can read the bits that are recorded right under it. Okay, or it can write new bits to that sector. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So now what? See, there's another picture here. Okay. So this is what a typical hard disk looks like. Okay. It essentially has multiple platters. Okay. So if you open up a hard disk, you will see that rather than having something like one CD, you have multiple of them that are stacked close to one another. So it's basically it has multiple platters and they are all spinning. Okay. There's one head that is looking at each platter. Okay. You can have your recording on both sides, in which case you can record on the top and on the bottom. Okay. In which case you are basically a dual recording, data recording. And now what you have essentially is these multiple sectors, but still at any point you can read or write from one platter. Okay, just because you have multiple platters doesn't mean this disk head can read from this platter and that one can read from that platter at the same time. Because there's only one pipe or one thing that comes out of this. So only one of these can be active, one head can be active. You can read or write from only one of these platters at any given time. Okay, that's something to keep in mind. Okay. So essentially you have this notion of a platter. Within each platter you have tracks. Okay, within a track you have sectors. Okay, so the way you will typically issue a read command to or a write command to a disk is go to this platter, go to platter number 4, which is here, okay, or that one, and say go to the certain track 10, okay, and then write to this sector. Okay, that will essentially address a certain region. Okay, so platter number, track number and sector number will identify a particular region, okay, a particular sector here on that disk. Okay, this is essentially how a read and write command would work. Okay, you will say read from this platter, this track, this sector, and then some data will come out. Or you write to this, will give some bits, you will go and write to that sector. Okay, so that's what a hard disk looks like. Now, it's important to understand what are the overheads in doing read and write operation to a disk. Okay, so suppose, okay, just for simplicity, let's assume a disk with only one platter. Okay, we'll assume that here is track 0, track 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, so this disk has 4 tracks, one single platter. Okay, and then maybe there are some number of sectors on each. Okay. That's your disk head. Currently it's positioned on the outermost track. Okay. So suppose a command comes in saying go to sector 0. Or not sector, track 0, sector 1. Okay, so essentially it says go and read the data that's recorded here. Okay, once you issue this command to the disk, what has to happen is first the disk head has to move and position itself on that track. Currently it's positioned on this track, so it can read data that's stored on this track, but that's not what you're interested in. You're interested in data that's recorded there. Okay. So you'll basically, your disk head will then move here. Okay, so it can move back and forth. Okay, so it's going to move here and position itself on this track. So it will move forward. It will come here. Okay, at that point you can read or write data from that track. Okay, the latency involved in moving the disk head from wherever it is to the track you're interested in is called a disk seek. Okay, the head is seeking to the right sector, right track. Okay, while the disk is seeking, there's no useful work happening. Okay, the head is just trying to position itself on the track you are interested in. Okay, so this is wasted work. The disk is not doing anything useful. Okay, now disk seek latencies are in the order of few milliseconds to tens of milliseconds. Okay, so typical disk drive, depends on how fast it is, you may have a disk seek overhead of average disk seek of 5 milliseconds. Which means for every request, you are first wasting 5 milliseconds trying to position the disk on the right track. Right? So this is why disk accesses are slow, because you are actually first you have to do a seek to the right location. Yes, question.
So does that seek time include the time that it takes for the disk to rotate to the right place as well? Or is
no,
that
I have not. This is just for the head to move.
Okay.
Okay, so I haven't talked about the rotational latency yet. Okay, this is called a seek latency. Once you are positioned yourself on the right track, you still cannot actually read or write the data you are interested in, because you may be positioned. Remember, this disk is continuously spinning. It's not a stationary thing, it's just spinning all the time. So when the disk head moves here, it may be that sector 2 is under the disk head right now and the sector 2 is spinning by. You have to wait until the sector you care about is actually spun by and is positioned right under the disk head. At that point, you can read or write whatever you care about. So in this case, you are interested in sector 1. The disk head is, when the disk head moves here, let's assume sector 2 is under the disk head. So you cannot do anything yet. So you have to wait until the disk spins a little bit and then this sector rotates. Okay, so this will spin. So sector 2 will go there, sector 1. So sector 1 has now appeared under the disk head. At this point, you can read the sector you care about. Okay. So even after you position the disk head on the track you care about, there is still a latency, okay, until the right sector spins by and is positioned under the disk head. This latency is called a rotational latency. Okay. This is also on the order of a few milliseconds, yeah, on an average. The rotational latency depends also on how quickly fast this disk is spinning. Okay, if you actually look at the specs of a disk drive, you will see something like it has 4800 RPM, okay, 5400 RPM, 7200 RPM and so on. Okay, the faster your disk spins, the smaller your rotational latency, because the time it takes for the right sector to spin by is lower because the disk platters are spinning faster. Okay, so if you buy a disk with higher RPM, it basically will have better performance. It will also cost more. Okay, so there are two overheads you have to deal with for every disk IO operation, which is the seek overhead and a rotational latency. And this is pure wasted work. Disk is not doing anything useful. Just waiting for the disk head to be positioned at the right place. Once your disk head is positioned on the right sector, at that point you can actually read or write bits. And that is referred to as the transfer time. The time it takes you to actually read or write bits is the transfer. That's the useful work that the disk is doing. It's either reading disks of the platter or writing to the platter. So any disk request has three components. The latency of a disk request. Latency of disk IO equals the seek plus the rotational latency plus the transfer time. Of these, the first two are essentially time that the disk is not doing anything useful. This is the part where the disk is doing something useful. Now it will be clear why we are talking about all this. Because when you talk about file systems, if you want good performance, you want to lay out your data on disk such that these two things are as low as possible. So we will see that there are scenarios where that is true and there are scenarios where that isn't. If you have lots of disk over seek overheads, your performance is going to be slow. If you have very little, performance is going to be great. Now, although this is how hard disks work, they are completely different from how solid state disks work. Solid state disk, there is no moving part. Essentially, your entire disk space looks like RAM. Basically, you have byte 0 to byte n. You can, and it's all electronic. So you can just go and access whichever byte you want. And the time to access it is constant. You don't actually worry about if there's no notion of a disk. Just as in RAM, you can go and address any byte on a solid state disk. Also, you can go and address any sector you want. Yes.
Well, the question was, is there no latency except for transfer?
There is no, other than the electronic latency to process the command, there is no latency at all. So this has implications. So what this says is, if you place blocks of the same file, where scatter them on a solid state disk, the time to access them will be less. But here you will pay in terms of disk seek overhead. If you have random access, your random access on a magnetic hard disk is slow. Random access on a solid state disk SSD is very fast, or maybe up to an order of magnitude faster. So if you have random access workload, you put an SSD under it, they will get a huge performance boost. So we will not talk about SSDs, but I just wanted to mention that. So I mentioned the file organization. So essentially what the file system is doing, you take a file and you chop it up into fixed size blocks. Blocks are essentially assigned to sectors on disk. So essentially, if you assume the block size is same as the sector size, you basically says you keep track of for file 0, block 0, that's where it is stored. That's the platter, that's the cylinder, that's the sector. For file 0, block 1, that's where it is stored. This is very similar to paging. Instead of frames, you have sectors of fixed size. Instead of pages, you have blocks of fixed size. You take a file, you chop it up into blocks, you assign blocks to sectors. And sectors and blocks are of the fixed same size. So what we have done here is we have relaxed the assumption that the file has to be stored contiguously on disk. Just as in paging, we didn't have that assumption. Same is true here. Otherwise, you would have the same problem of fragmentation. Is that clear? So this is one information that your file system needs to track. We'll see how you track that, but keep that in mind. So now we look at what should the file system do to support both random and sequential access efficiently? What data structures do you maintain? And how do we lay out files on disk? So we look at some file system organizations and try to answer some of these questions. So to do that, we need to understand the characteristics of files. So there are two or three to keep in mind. The first thing is that most files that you have on a typical file system are very small. The average size of a file on a typical file system is on the order of 3 or 4 kilobytes. Okay, if you just take a disk on any PC, okay, you take all the files and just look at all the file sizes, you will see that 90% of the files will be very small, okay, or even greater than 90%. Okay, and then our mean file size even today is on the order of a few kilobytes, 3 to 4 kilobytes. Okay, that said, most of the disk space on your disk is taken up by large files. So lots of little files, but they, even in the aggregate, they don't take up too much space because they are all small. Okay, if you say where is my disk space gone, you will see that there are some humongous ones that are actually consuming most of the disk space. Maybe they are music files, video files, large images, okay, or tars of some zip files that contain archives of something. So those all happen to be large. Okay, so it's like the 80-20 or the 90-10 rule. 90% of the files are small, 10% of the files take up 90% of the disk space. Okay? So, large number of small files, small number of large files. Okay? And then, typically if you take any application, you will all access both small and large files. Okay, some applications will access large files. If you have a DVD player and you have a movie stored on your disk, it's going to access a large file. You have a source, you have, let's say, word processor, Microsoft Word, you may be opening up a small file. Okay, so you basically, your file system has to support I/O operations on both large and small files, as well as sequential and random access on both small and large files. Okay, so you want to design a file system that takes all of these characteristics into account. Okay, so per file cost must be low, but the performance when you try to access very large files shouldn't be bad. And we'll see that this, basically the reason I'm mentioning this is this results in some design trade-offs. Okay, inherently, if you optimize your file system for small file accesses, there will be some penalty you will have to pay for accessing large files. And vice versa, if you optimize it for large file accesses, you will pay some penalties for small. You can't do both very well. You want to try to balance them as much as possible. Okay, but doing one is always at the expense of the other. Okay, so let's look with that background. Let's start with some file system allocation. Okay, simplest one which we will go through quickly but not talk about in detail is contiguous allocation. Okay, just as you laid out in contiguous memory allocation, the process was laid contiguously. This is a file is laid contiguously on disk. So you create a 33 kilobyte file, you find a 33 kilobyte chunk on your disk that is free, and you lay that file out there. So most file systems will not even bother to do this, but it's instructive to start with this. Okay. So basically, for each file, you will only need to store the start location of that file on disk, which track, which platter, and which sector does it start on, and the size, and it's stored contiguously, contiguous sectors from that point on. Okay. So it's very simple. Okay. Access time to access a file is what? How many seeks will you incur to access this file?
One.
Just one. You'll basically go seek to the beginning of the file, and from that point on you can read the entire file contiguously. There's no more seeks. So one seek, one rotational latency, and then you read the whole file. Okay, so it, in that sense it's efficient. Okay, you incur only one seek to access the whole file. Okay. Disadvantage is all the problems we had with contiguous memory allocation. We'll get external fragmentation. As files get created and deleted, you will have holes on disk, you will have fragmentation, and bigger problem is file sizes may change. Okay, file sizes are not static. You open a file, you add something, let's say you open a Java file, you add some lines of code, you save it, the file size has increased. Okay, if you are exactly in a hole where there is no more space, then you have to move that file somewhere. Okay, so file growth is not easily handled in this case. Okay. The only place where it's widely used is write-only disks. What's an example for write-only disk? Write once disk, not write-only disk.
Okay.
Tape drive, yes. Any other examples? Okay, CD and DVD. If you burn a CD, okay, you do this once. So the burn, your burning program actually takes all the data you want to lay it out, and it just lays it out contiguously. Every file that you have stored on your CD is actually contiguous, because there is no question of it growing or changing. Once you burnt it, you are done. Okay, so on write once, read many devices, called worm devices. Okay, write once, read many, that's acronym for worm. Okay, you can do contiguous allocation. Okay, because none of this really matters. Okay, this, and it's efficient. Okay, there's no changing file size, there's no fragmentation. So these disadvantages don't exist. Advantages are great. Okay, so it's efficient to access. Okay, very early mainframe operating system back in the 60s actually started with this. Okay, but then they quickly gave up as fragmentation became an issue. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now we'll see how to relax it. Second file organization is a linked list. Okay, so this is what your file looks like. Your file is chopped up into, as usual, is chopped up into fixed size blocks. Okay, any file has certain number of blocks, each of a fixed size. Okay, and at the end of each block, you put a pointer to the next block of this file. Okay, so this is the file descriptor. This is the metadata. Here you have the file name and whatnot, all the owner protection bits. And here you have a pointer to the first block. Okay, this basically, what is here is basically this thing, platter. The first block is platter 4 cylinder 20 sector 5. So then you read this and then you basically do a seek to that location and you read this. Okay. Once you have read this block, at the end of that block, the last few bytes essentially point to the next chunk of the file, the next block and so on. Okay, so it's basically a linked list organization. Okay. So early versions of DOS, well, not early, all versions of DOS for that matter, use this. Okay, if you know of the FAT file system, you must have heard of FAT32 and FAT. So there was something called FAT8, this was essentially this. Okay, it's an 8-bit file system that essentially did this for files. Okay, so what are the advantages and disadvantages? Okay, so fragmentation. We have fragmentation in linked list organization.
No.
No fragmentation. Okay, because you have basically chopped up the file into blocks and you are assigning blocks to sectors. And you relax the assumption that the file has to be contiguous. So if there's any sector free, you can put data there. Okay, so there's no fragmentation. Internal fragmentation you'll have, but external fragmentation is gone. Okay. Can this accommodate changes to file size? Okay, that's pretty easy. File grows in size. Okay, you have allocate one more sector, put a pointer there. Okay, file decreases in size, you can throw this out and blank out that pointer. Okay, so file can grow and shrink as you wish. Okay. So what about sequential access? Efficient? Yes. Sequential access, you just start here and you just keep reading the file. Okay, as you read each block, you know where the next block is stored, you go fetch that block and so on. Okay?
Yes, the size
of the file would be in the file descriptor. Okay, so you know that there are 10 blocks, you'll read the first block, then the second block and so on. Sequential access is not a problem. Random access is a big problem. Okay, if you say go and access the 10th block of the file, you always have to start from the beginning and walk this linked list until you get to the 10th block. So if you have a very large file and you want to seek to some place at the very end, you will have to walk the entire linked list. Okay, so sequential access is order n. It's very slow. Yes.
Yeah, wouldn't sequential access be really slow because you need to do the seek time every time?
Yes. So sequential access is slower than contiguous allocation. In contiguous allocation, there was one seek, one rotational latency, and you could read the entire file. Okay. In this case, there is one seek per block. Okay. But one seek per block, if you think about it, if you relax the assumption that the file has to be stored contiguously, if the file is scattered all over disk and you want to read it sequentially, there is no choice. When you go from block I to block I plus 1, you have to do a seek because block I plus 1 is somewhere else on disk. Okay? So sequential performance is slower than contiguous allocation. You cannot do any better than contiguous allocation for sequential access. Okay, but then if you have non-contiguous allocation, you have to pay the price. When you go from one contiguous chunk to another, there's always a seek involved. Okay? Yes, question.
So, although it inherently supports non-contiguous allocation, do you
you know, periodically optimize it, and so try to get it as close to getting as possible.
Yes. So if you ever have run a defragment program on your hard disk, which you find in Windows often, essentially what it is doing is it'll take all of these blocks and it'll try to store them close to one another. Okay, so this pointer here is actually pointing to the next block. This pointer is pointing to the next block and so on. Okay, which will optimize performance for sequential access, because then sequential access you'll just keep reading. Okay, just because you can store it non-contiguously doesn't mean you have to. Okay, you can do it when you want, but if you want better performance, you can still find large chunks of space on disk and store an entire file there, okay, although it's a linked list. Okay, so that is essentially what a defragmenter does. But all that said, random access is still horrendous. Okay, because if you want to access the ith block, you will have to have I disk seeks before you even figure out where this block is stored on disk. Okay, so you have to essentially always read the entire file, or not the entire file, the entire prefix of the file to get to block I. Okay, so not good random access, okay sequential access, okay, worse than contiguous allocation, but if you do defragment and things like that, sequential access is not bad. Okay, yes, question.
So we call that defragmentation, but it's not actually like the other kind of fragmentation we were talking about.
No. Yeah, defragmentation, the name has stayed. Defragmentation programs actually came from file systems that were doing contiguous memory allocation. These are actually performance optimizers, really. They are not doing any real defragmentation because there is no external defragmentation. For whatever reason, the program name is still defragment, although it's not doing anything to defragment your disk. Okay. So, FAT file systems in MS-DOS essentially do this. The number of seeks, if you have random access to get to the ith block, you have I seeks. Okay? In sequential access, you have one seek per block. Okay? So those are the things to keep in mind. Okay? So now we'll come to some other data structure. So both of these are actually used in real file system. Right? So this is any ISO file system, which is what is you have on CD-ROMs and DVDs, use contiguous. DOS essentially use linked files. So the other thing I should mention in linked files is the free blocks, the free sectors on your disk in a linked list organization is also a linked list. Okay, so let me just go away from the concentric circle. So let's say your disk has basically 0 through n sectors. Okay, this is file 1. And so on. So this is basically a linked list. So what you do, the way you track free blocks in a linked list organization is you basically create a special file that's not visible to anything other than the file system. It's called the free list. And the head of the free list points to the first free block, the first sector that's free. In this sector, you will basically store the pointer to the next free block. And in this sector, you'll store a pointer to the next free block and so on. Okay? So your entire free list looks like a file. It's just a file with garbage sectors, I mean sectors that have essentially no data in them. Okay, so file deletion is trivial. Okay, to delete a file, all you have to do is take this entire chain and just add it to that free block list. So at the end of this, we just put a pointer to the existing free block and you just added all these blocks to the free block list. Okay, so and you're done. Okay, yes, question.
Where would you store the head of the free blocks? How do you know
where? Okay, where do you store the head? So there is always some additional space on disk where you store extra information. This is where you store metadata. Okay, so I once told you where the file name, all the owner, all that information is stored. So that is actually stored in a special block on your disk. Okay, it's also called a super block. A super block actually is all the where all of the metadata is stored. So there, that's where you will actually store the head to the free block list and so on. Okay.
Wouldn't that vary though based on which file system you use?
Yes, it will very much vary. term superblock only applies to Unix file system, and I'll talk about one. Okay, but that's basically, there's some metadata region on disk where you don't store any file data, you store some metadata. Okay, so linked list was the next and last one that we'll talk about, is what is called indexed file organization. Okay. So in the indexed file organization, so this is the picture to keep in mind. This is the metadata, the file descriptor, okay, is the metadata for your file system. For every file, there is a file descriptor. So you have the name of the file, the unique ID of the, not the name, but the unique ID of the file, the owner of the file, the permission bits, the size of the file, last modified times of the file, and so on. So all of that is stored, and then essentially have a set of pointers. Okay, so there is some number of them. Each of this will point to one block of the file. Okay, just as in a page table has a mapping from page to frames. This is a mapping from block 0, this is the location on disk, block 1, this is the location on disk, and so on. Okay, it's an array of disk block sectors. Okay, block I, or entry I, essentially points to block I of that file. And it tells you where on disk is that in a block stored. Okay, so I said this is essentially an index structure. Okay, so now let's talk about advantages and disadvantages. Okay, so the main advantage of this structure is that both sequential and random access are efficient. Okay, if you wanted to do random access, once you open the file, this file descriptor is going to get read into memory. It's going to be stored in the per process and the open file table that we had talked about. So since this index is already in memory, if you wanted to access block I, you just look up the ith entry that tells your disk block address, you just go and read that block. Okay, so you can basically jump to any block of the file just by accessing its corresponding disk block address entry in the file descriptor. Okay, sequential access is also efficient because you just walk through this file descriptor saying where is block 0, get the address, read block 0, where is block 1, you read, get the address, read block 1, and so on. Okay, so you can read the file sequentially or at random and still have good performance. Okay, so how much disk seek overhead are we going to pay for each type of access, sequential and random? Sequential?
Two.
Two. What does that mean?
You have to do that.
Okay, so let's assume you read the file descriptor. Yes? Okay, so then one per block, not one for the file. Contiguous allocation is one for the entire file. Okay, you go to the beginning of the file and the rest of the file is just stored contiguously. For linked list and for indexed organization is one seek per block, because this block and this block are not contiguous. After you read this block, you have to seek to the location of this block, and you have to seek to the location of the next block, and so on. So important to keep in mind, it's whether it's a seek per disk block or a seek per file. Okay, very different performance for the two. Okay, so this one is a disk seek per block when you do sequential. What about random? Okay, random is 2, because you will read the file descriptor, that one disk, and then you will look up the corresponding entry, you do a seek to that block. Okay, essentially constant time. Okay, you can jump to any block without any penalty in constant time. Okay, so both sequential and random access are efficient. Okay, disadvantage is it's going to set our maximum file size. In the linked list organization, there is no limit to the file size. Your file can be as large as your disk, because it's just a linked list, it keeps growing. In an indexed organization, there is a limit to the file size. Why is there a limit? Yes. Okay. So if this is the file descriptor, you basically have space to store 6 block pointers. That's as big as your file can be, because that's the size of the file descriptor. the file descriptor govern the size of the file. The larger your file descriptor, the more the larger your file can be. Okay, but that is going to basically limit the size of your file. The number of entries in this data structure limits the number of blocks you can have in the file. That limits the maximum file size. So you can't grow beyond this. Okay, so that's a problem. We don't want the linked list organization. This is the only advantage a linked list organization has over pure indexed organization. In linked list, there is no limit. Here there is a limit, the no limit, as in the limit is the same as the disk size. Here the limit is basically governed by the descriptor size, not the disk size. So now, to get rid of this limit, we'll actually look at another organization. Okay, this is called multi-level indexed files. Okay, just as we had multi-level page tables, and at that point I said when we revisit file systems, we'll look at similar organizations. Okay. So this is what is actually used in Unix. Okay. So Unix file systems essentially use this type of organization. So you have a file descriptor that's of fixed size. Okay. Typically, this file descriptor has, 14 pointers. Okay. This is fixed size that has only 14 pointers, okay, pre-allocated. Okay. This file descriptor in Unix is called an inode. Inode stands for an index node. Okay. That's basically this index. Okay. The first 12 entries, okay, so in this organization, the first 12 entries point to the first 12 blocks of the file. Okay. So you can accommodate up to 12 blocks without any problem. You will just store the first block address here, the second one here, and up to 12 entries. If your file grows beyond 12 entries, okay, what you will do is you will basically allocate a pointer to another disk block. And this disk block will actually a pointer to real data. This is just a pointer to a block which is an index block. Okay, and this is going to be pointing to real disk block. This is only allocated on the fly if your file grows beyond 12 blocks. When you go into the 13th block, this one more block is allocated on disk. This block actually points to actual blocks on file. This, since this is actually an actual disk block, it can store anywhere from 512 to 1024 entries. If this is a 4K disk block, you can store up to 1000 entries. The next 1000 blocks can be accommodated here. Okay. If you grow beyond 12 plus 1024 blocks, okay, then you used up that entry. So then you will go to the last entry in here. Okay, that is called a double indirect block. So what you will do is you will allocate a disk block, one index block. Each entry in that index block will point to another index block. And each of those entries will actually point to disk blocks. In more modern Unix file system, there is another entry here which will have triple indirect. So each of these pointers will point to a block that will point to a double indirect block that will point to another block which points to disk blocks. Yes, question.
But even in the case of two and three levels of indirection, it's still finite. It's just...
Yes, exactly right. So even with this organization, you will basically still have a limit on the file size. It is just that the file size is large. Okay, this is why if you have any old version of Linux or Windows, it will say that the can't have a file that's greater than 2 GB. Okay, this 2 GB limit actually came from having a fixed number of entries here. And now files can be bigger than 2 GB. If you rip a DVD, that's itself 4 or 8 GBs. Okay, so your file sizes have to go. For that, these structures have been extended to accommodate larger and larger files. Okay, yes, question.
So why is there a... finite number, because can't each of those
X
files point to more?
Let me show you why. Draw that 4 picture here. Okay, so this is your inode. Okay, so there are, let's say, 13 entries or 14 entries here. So 0 through 11 point to direct disk blocks. Okay, so until your file grows to 12 blocks, there's no problem. You actually store here. This one points to one block, and there are 1024 point. This block can hold 1024 pointers, so actual disk data. Okay, this is blocks of the file. This is block 0, block 1. This is going to be block 12, 13, 1035. Okay. This one will point to another one. This is a double indirect block. This is called single indirect. One level of indirection. These are direct. This is single indirect. This is a double indirect. Okay. Each of this will point to another index block, and each of those has 1024 entries to actual disk blocks. Okay. So this will accommodate 1024 square blocks. This accommodates 1024 block. This accommodates 12 blocks. So this file descriptor can accommodate file sizes up to that many blocks, because there are no more entries beyond this.
So why couldn't we just have the last block on each file descriptor point to another index file, so that we get kind of a linked list structure of index files and have larger index files?
Another inode, you mean? So I think they don't do that. You could certainly do that. You will have a different file system organization. Okay. So modern file systems actually have one more, which is a triple indirect. Okay, three levels of indirection. So you can actually go to. So that's the file size, the limit on the file size. That many blocks. The file grows beyond that many blocks, you will basically, your file system will throw an error. Okay, that's pretty high. So for most files, that's sufficient. But if you have need for a really large file, you might actually exceed that. Okay. So now you can ask the question, why do you have such a crazy structure? Okay, why is it that there's one level, two level, three level? Why not make every block have three levels of indirection? Okay, why did we have some direct pointers? Why could this all of these not have three levels of indirection? So then it becomes more uniform. Okay, why come through all this extra work to do? Yes, question.
Well, I mean, wouldn't that be performance optimization if you had a bunch of, if most of your files were small, you had sort of exponentially?
Yes. So the reason for this organization is to go back to the 90-10 rule, which says most files are small. Okay, as I said, most files actually, empirically, the average size of a file on a typical disk of a laptop or a PC is 3 or 4 kilobytes. That's about less than one block. Okay, so for most files, you will never have all of this. You will just have a few block pointers here. In most cases, there will be only one pointer. The disk, entire file fits in one disk block. Okay, so all you need to do to access that file is access the file descriptor, look at the first entry, access the disk block, you are done. There's nothing more to it. Okay. So what this structure does is it slowly penalizes files as the files grow bigger. Okay. If the file size is less than 12 blocks, you can basically have direct pointers. You can just access them once you access the file, the inode. The file grows beyond 12 blocks, you will basically, for every block beyond the 12th block, there will be one extra disk access, because you'll have to read this block. And then you have access to the next 1024 entries or disk blocks of the file. If it grows beyond 1035 blocks, then you have two levels of indirection to get to all of your data. If you grow beyond that, you have three levels of indirection. Okay. So the hope is, as since larger files are less and less common, there will be only a very few files that get penalized with multiple levels of indirection. So smaller files are getting better performance here. Okay. So essentially you try to optimize for the common case, which is most files are small and most of them can be accommodated using direct file pointers. As file grows, progressively grows larger, you pay a slightly higher performance over it, but even then random access is still efficient. Okay? Even for very large files, the random access is only 3 disk IOs. Okay? Unlike in linked list where you have to traverse up to I blocks to get to the ith block, here it's still constant time. Okay? Three disk accesses is not as fast as one, but still it is bounded. Okay, so this is the Unix philosophy, right? So optimize for the common case and yet have reasonable performance, not great, but reasonable performance for the uncommon case, which is very large files. Okay, so this is why this is a non-uniform index structure. This is why it's not all three levels of indirection for every file. Okay, because that would imply that you are penalizing all files regardless of whether they are small or large. Okay. Now only one extra thing I'll mention here is Linux adds one more optimization to this. If you have really tiny files, okay, files that are less than, let's say, 10 or 12 bytes in size, the entire file is actually stored in the inode, because the whole file can be accommodated here. So if you create an empty file or a file which is, let's say, 3 bytes, the whole file is actually stored here. Rather than allocating a disk block and using only the first few bytes, you put the whole file here. Okay, only if the file grows beyond 12 bytes do you even allocate a disk block for guest question. Most of the symbolic links can be small enough to actually put in the inode itself, because it's just a small string, you can put it there. Okay, if it's a long string, then you have to actually allocate a block. Okay, so quickly, the advantages and disadvantages. Simple, well, I don't know, it's not necessarily that simple, but it is still an index structure. Supports incremental growth, okay, and it's basically sequential access is still bounded. Okay, if it's first 12 blocks, you access the file descriptor and then one disk seek. If it's beyond 12 blocks, you'll have two disk seeks, okay, and then beyond that, there'll be three disk seeks, but it's still bounded. Random access still reasonable. Okay, no more than three disk seek for any block of the file, regardless of how large the file is. For most cases, it's less than three. Okay, the only file size is still limited. Okay, it's limited to that value, the number of single, double, and indirect block pointers there are. Okay, so that tells you the maximum number of blocks. Okay, that times the block size tells you the maximum file size in bytes. Okay, still bounded. Okay, and then this is essentially used in this index structure was first proposed in BSD Unix. It's now common in most file systems. This is essentially what any Unix machine of any sort uses, this type of organization. Okay, so we are going to stop here. You run out of time. So we'll continue this discussion next Tuesday.
So with this,
just one second.